Hello and welcome back to Nerds Amalgamated. I'm the Professor and my co-host is the DJ. How are you going, DJ?
Oh, I'm going good. It's in the middle of spring, changing all my Spotify tunes from sad winter songs to happy spring songs.
I found out more about you tonight than I ever thought I would.
Hey, I gotta say this.
I found out some very exciting news.
Oh, yeah?
Russell T Davies is coming back to Doctor Who.
Oh, yay.
What? You got a problem with Rusty?
No, I don't have any problem with Rusty. I just have a problem with the last remaining... what's left of the fandom. The Doctor... with the news. I wonder how many of it's left, given what Chibnall and Whittaker did to the show.
I'd say it's more Chibnall. I think Jodie can be the Doctor, but I don't think Chibnall can write for the Doctor. Some of his stuff's alright, but a lot of it really misses the mark.
And after that season finale, I don't know, man. when you retconned it, that the origin of the Doctor to basically, I found this orphan, and that's it.
Yeah, that was not popular.
Like it wasn't also the fact that they retconned the whole writing of the Doctor's origin. It was also the fact that they basically just used it as a platform to just preach to people, like, oh, everything's bad, guy. This is the current times. Everything is bad.
I think it's people who say that this is new are bloody idiots, because Doctor Who has always been having digs at politics and religion. In fact, I'd say that some of the older stories from, you know, the 70s were even more aggressive towards religion and politics.
I get that, but here's the problem, okay? Back then, it was like you leave it to the audience to make up their own minds and do stuff. But this time, it's just, okay, we're going to force people to do this. You know what I mean?
Just say Chris Chibnall can't do subtlety.
Like, it's like a person, it's like Jodie Whittaker looking at the audience, winking at the camera and go, and now, you must do this!
Yeah, that's all on Chibnall.
Yeah. And that's why people have just kind of gone, you know what, I'm out of this Doctor Who fandom. But,
If you're gonna leave Doctor Who because it's preachy and it has opinions, you would have left years ago.
If you left
Doctor Who because of Chibnall, own it and say that you left because of Chibnall.
I can
do the Doctor. She's absolutely fantastic when the spark hits. My favourite part of her actually never made it to TV. It's her doing the... Way back when COVID started, she did a short video on Instagram or Twitter or something, dressed up in her costume, hiding in a cupboard, reminding people to be brave and kind. And that is... The way she did that was very Doctor.
But yeah,
when she's working with Chris Chibnall, everything falls apart.
Yep, that's what I mean. It's just... it's just when it's with Chibnall, it's just... what was I thinking? That kind of thing. And plus, like, Jodie has some... Also, has some part to be blamed in terms of... What went wrong? Like, for example, a couple of puff pieces at Jodie Whittaker. Jodie Whittaker, like, she wasn't really like grateful at the whole thing. She was just like, oh, I'm just gonna use this to berate people, kind of thing. Okay, and she didn't really. Oh, sorry.
Not every actor who joins Doctor Who is a Doctor Who fan. Not every, like, there's a certain gravity to getting the job. You know, there's 50 years of history there. But not everyone who has had the job has been a super fan. Sometimes it works out that the super fans are absolutely amazing. Peter Capaldi.
Oh, yeah.
You don't have to be a super fan of Doctor Who to do a good job with it.
We've just been very
lucky that the past 10 years or so have been full of super fans.
Oh yeah, and they were all. And here's the thing: most of those super fans, like for example, David Tennant, Christopher Eccleston, Matt Smith, Capaldi, they were all grateful at the fact that they were chosen for the role. Like, but when it comes to Jodie Whittaker, you didn't really get the whole like, "I'm grateful for this role," that kind of thing.
I think she was grateful for it. I think I think it depends on where you're reading, because certain interviews definitely play up the whole first female actress playing the Doctor and so on. But some of them, she did show that she was really into it. Anyway, what's really interesting is that we're getting Russell T Davies back. So if you've gotten to this point and don't know who he is, he was the one responsible for reviving Doctor Who. He was the showrunner from 2005 to 2010. He also did Torchwood. And it's not just him coming back. We've also got some of the key parts of his production team.
Oh, yeah?
We've got Jane Tranter and Julie Gardner. So they spun off their own studio called Bad Wolf Studios and are now being brought in as partners on producing Doctor Who. So they're really just cleaning the house out. Just get rid of everything, start from scratch, see what happens.
Okay. While Russell T Davies' addition and Bad Wolf's inclusion into the Doctor Who franchise is a good thing, the big, big question remains. Who is going to play as the Doctor?
We don't know yet.
That's going to be a big one because ever since Jodie Whittaker said that she was leaving the Doctor Who role, a lot of people are putting bets on who will be the next Doctor.
That happens every time, and I've never put any stock into it, because half the time they're wrong.
Like, last I remember, it was, they wanted to add in a gay guy, for example, and put him as the first gay Doctor, apparently.
Well, the BBC does have a bit of a rock and a hard place here. Do they double down and bring in another female Doctor, which I think would come across as a bit pandering? Or do they go back and just pick whoever's best for the job, which some people could see as them saying female Doctors were a mistake, which they're not. A female actress can play the Doctor and can be absolutely fantastic in the role. We all love Ruth.
I mean,
that's what really showed up, that Jodie Whittaker wasn't getting room to act as the Doctor in the show, because when Ruth turned up, Ruth absolutely owned it.
Yeah, when Ruth showed... Yeah, I get that. The Ruth character. But the part really that got to me was the whole... Yeah, before William Hartnell, the first Doctor, it was Ruth.
Well, ignoring all of that, and it's not just Ruth. There's also the unnamed Doctor who only showed up in the flashbacks as that detective.
Yeah.
Well, so ignoring all of that, though, Ruth had... I can't remember the actress's name.
Jo Martin,
that's it. She had a presence that Jodie Whittaker has been unable to bring for most of the series. And I think Jodie's definitely capable of it. I think it's more of the whole environment, which I hope is different, because Christopher Eccleston himself went through some pretty hard mental health issues while he was working on Doctor Who. And ended up anorexic.
I remember that.
And yeah, that's a big part of the reason why he didn't come back for the 50th. If he had, then he basically would have filled the role of the War Doctor. But they didn't bring him back because he wanted nothing to do with the BBC. We don't know the full details, we might never find out, but he really didn't get along with the BBC when he was there. And he's worked in other stuff since, but I don't think he wants anything to do with Russell T Davies or Keith Bogg, I think, the director at the time.
But they never say never. I mean, Eccleston's gone back to Doctor Who stuff lately.
But only outside the BBC, which, to be fair, is how most of them do it. But he's not, like, currently he's only doing Big Finish, and it's been, 15 years since he was a Doctor. And he's only just getting back into it. A lot of Doctors are into it a lot sooner than that. To be fair, we don't have the biggest sample size, but they don't necessarily wait 15 years. And Big Finish is a separate thing, so none of the production team from Big Finish as far as I know, worked on the show, except for a couple of the other actors.
Hmm.
I just think it's going to be a bit of a tightrope walk between reliving the glory days and just trying to emulate the original Russell T Davies years without realizing what actually made it good and the risk that they'll mess it up that way.
Yeah. And the other question is going to be how much creative control Russell have, because when tons. Chibnall was tons?
Yeah. They basically give the showrunner free reign.
Hmm. Because if I recall, like with Chibnall, they didn't really give him that much control, if I recall.
Really?
I think so.
You don't think the guy who retconned literally the entire history of the show had any control?
Well, how many writers were under his belt at the time?
Well, that's how it's always been. But traditionally, there's the showrunner who writes at least the outline for most of the episodes. And in recent years, they've been bringing in more and more guest writers, because the showrunner just can't keep up. And that's how Stephen Moffat and Chris Chibnall both got started on Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
They both worked under Russell T Davies.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a bit of a long tradition that they'll do the majority of the story by a particular showrunning writer, and then a handful of other details by episodes by another writer.
Yeah. And hopefully, I hope they bring in some competent writers. I mean, there were so many inconsistencies.
Yeah, I think with the change, they're going to fit in a few more. They're basically swapping the entire crew, the entire team. So I think they'll definitely find a few new people to fill it out. I'd like to see Neil Gaiman come back.
Oh, you know who I want to see come back into this new Doctor Who? If Russell T comes back, and I'm hoping and praying this becomes reality, Murray Gold does the music again. Because goddamn that...
Yes.
Because goddamn his music was epic.
Yeah, I've missed his music.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, the other question I have, though, in terms of Russell T Davies coming back, it will be, is this the first step to rebuilding/fixing the fandom?
I think I'm not convinced this isn't a massive Hail Mary where they're pulling out things that they work to try to draw people back in. So it'll depend on whether it ends up as just bringing in Russell to tick the boxes, or if they actually get some quality content out of him.
And I hope the BBC doesn't do the whole, all right, we're gonna make this Doctor Who a Doctor Who show which will tick every box.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of speculation with it. We really don't know a whole lot yet.
Yeah, yeah, that's fair.
The show's been around bloody ever, but we never really know what's going to happen next, because the format of the show lets them just throw it away and start again if they want to.
Like, if Russell T Davies, if he does it right, I would love to see the Doctor versus the Master. Well, okay, yeah, that does feel like we've just added all over again. But at least do a bit of a change to the whole Doctor versus Master battle.
I feel like we're gonna get the Master back no matter what. The only Doctor who I can think of never had the Master off the top of my head was Matt Smith. Definitely the only new Doctor.
Actually, you might be right.
Actually, no, Christopher Eccleston got away with it. But to be fair, Christopher Eccleston's second season was David Tennant's first season.
Yeah.
So it's entirely possible that had Christopher Eccleston stayed for another 2 or 3 years, he would have had those same plot points as well. But by leaving it after the first season, he kind of missed out on a whole lot. He missed out on the Cybermen coming back.
He missed out on the Dalek versus Cybermen battle.
Yeah.
That was a fun battle.
I love the sassy argument between the Cybermen and the Daleks before that.
But see, I don't think we'll ever see that in the new Doctor. In the new Doctor Who, we will... we'll never see it because it will just be oh okay, Cybermen. It'll be the thing. It'll be the only villain. Like Daleks are, they're technically dead, aren't they? At this point.
No, I mean being dead in Doctor Who doesn't mean a whole lot. If they want to bring back the Daleks, they'll find an excuse. The same thing that every time they've decided to knock out the Daleks semi-permanently, a year or two later, they're like, hey, let's bring back the Daleks. Theoretically, from what I've heard, it could be because it's a contractual obligation with the Terry Nation estate. So some weirdness went on in the BBC in the 60s. I don't know if it was like that with every show, but some of the original Doctor Who creators got to take away parts of the IP. So Terry Nation's estate owns Daleks.
Ooh.
K-9 belongs to, what's his name? Something Baker? Not Tom Baker or Colin Baker, but the writer who came up with K-9 owns the idea of K-9.
Oh, yeah.
But the BBC owns the design of K-9. So when that K-9 spin-off show came out a few years ago, they had to come up with their own K-9.
Hang on a second. Bob Baker,
that's it. So there's a theory that there's a contractual obligation that they have to show the Daleks every year or so, keep access to them with Terry Nation. But that's getting into the internal stuff that we can't really confirm or deny.
Oh, do you know? Okay, do you know? It'd be awesome though. For I don't know whether this might be this may sound stupid, but if Russell T Davies comes back, I would love to see probably like a Sarah Jane story. Probably. I know the character is dead and the actress is dead.
Good.
Yeah, I know that.
I mean, not good as in she's dead, but I was going to be like, going to have to burst your bubble there.
But like maybe we can have like the daughter or something like that, you know?
Well, yeah, I wonder if they could reboot Sarah Jane Adventures using the children who aren't children anymore. It's, you know, been more than 10 years since the show started.
Yeah.
But there are the... I don't remember what they were called. There was Clyde. I never really watched Sarah Jane Adventures. It wasn't really available in Australia at the time.
There was... I might pick it up. There was Rani, Luke, Sarah Jane, Clyde, and Skye.
Yeah, so I reckon they could bring back Luke. Because Luke himself is an alien clone or something.
Yeah. Or maybe they could bring in Sadie Miller. She is the daughter of Elizabeth Sladen, and she could play as Sarah Jane, as the daughter of Sarah Jane, you know?
Well, it wouldn't be the first time a child of a doctor has played their parent, because Patrick Troughton's son... Damn, I'm doing really badly with names tonight. But Patrick Troughton's son has... No, I'm thinking of Pertwee. I might be thinking of Sean Pertwee. Has filled in as his dad in some of the voice episodes, the voice acting parts for Big Finish.
Oh, yeah. Sean Pertwee. I have seen him before. If my memory serves me, he reminds me of someone.
His dad? John Pertwee?
No, he was, he's the guy who played, he's the guy who plays Alfred in the series Gotham. That's okay. Where I've seen him before. Huh. Oh, I didn't know he was a Doctor Who person, too. Huh.
Yeah, only in these sorts of side roles.
But interestingly, with Russell's addition, on the 60th anniversary, that's a very good inclusion.
Yeah, he's got a couple of years now to get ready for that. Actually, running out of time now. Let's see, if he wants to get it done by November 2023, he's really only got a bit over 2 years.
Yeah. Overall, with Doctor Who, while I think it's great to see Russell coming back, I just hope the BBC and other stuff don't force him down the throat, going like, okay, we want you to do this and this and this, and yeah, give him absolute control.
I hope he gets as much control as he needs.
Yeah.
Although he does seem pretty excited about doing a cinematic universe.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Why is everyone...
He had a comment. Okay, he was doing it before everyone else did. He did it before it was cool.
Oh, what is...
There's a comment from him here. I was in the middle of running an empire. And my God, I did that 10 years too soon, didn't I? There should be a Doctor Who channel now.
Oh, God, no. Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, he's got some examples. He thinks maybe the Nyssa show or the 10th and the 11th Doctor teaming up.
Okay, the 10th and the 11th Doctor, I could see that. Yeah.
They've already done that, remember? The 50th?
Oh, yeah. That's right. Yeah. I would love to see David Tennant, Matt Smith, and Capaldi working together. Now, that'd be great.
They've already done that.
They did that?
50th?
Oh, but Capaldi really...
It was just Peter Capaldi's eyebrows, but he was there.
Yeah. See, that's what I mean, yeah. Like, I would love to see them all just acting in one screen, just go like, just see them bickering at each other. Just go like, no, you got it wrong.
Sort of Brains of Morbius style. When the various personalities of the Doctor had a bit of an argument.
Yeah. But that's the thing with, so it wasn't Russell T Davies, but, like, there was a lot of, like, inattention, and that was beautiful, what we saw in all of the other, with Smith and Tennant, like, there was always this tension within them. Like, you didn't really see that in the Whittaker saga. It was just like, I'm just gonna be a hyperactive child and go all over the place, da 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 da, that's it, like.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a weak point that Jodie Whittaker has never had a chance to go dark, because one of the recurring themes of the new revival is basically that the Doctor is a good-hearted person, but if you push the Doctor will go and absolutely wreck you.
Unless that whole, remember that there was that scene where she and the master were having a Mexican standoff-ish kind of thing, and she has the detonator. I think that was trying to signify her as going dark.
Yeah, so I'm not sure Doctor Who is the show to do a cinematic universe with.
Nah.
I think there's some fun stuff you could do with.
I mean,
but I think you could very easily oversaturate the content, and I don't think it's something to start right now. I think give it a couple of years, build up the popularity again, and then see where you go.
And here's the question. If they're going to do a cinematic universe, who is really going to be the big, big bad guy? Like, Marvel had Thanos, DC had Darkseid.
It can be whatever you want. It can be the Master again, again, the Cybermen again. To be fair, when they last did the sort of cinematic universe thing with Torchwood, it all tied together to the Daleks. That was Journey's End was, like, people say Avengers is the biggest crossover ever. No, mate, it's Journey's End.
Okay, what about
Journey's End had the Doctor, Sarah Jane, Torchwood. It all came back together for that.
I thought the last Torchwood story was the what was it? It wasn't the final episode of Torchwood.
Miracle Day.
That's the one. Yep, that's the one.
That's a separate timeline, but technically they're the same universe, but they never really crossed over Children of Earth or Miracle Day to Doctor Who.
Okay.
So I think it was impacted by Torchwood being an adult show.
Hmm.
Like, literally the second episode of Torchwood is about an alien that possesses people, then has sex with people and sucks their souls out.
Wait, did you say second episode or?
Yeah, the second one. The first one was about using a magical glove to bring people back to life. Wait a minute.
Wait, what?
That's just like, just the plot of an Endgame, isn't it?
Yeah. I have the...
They had their crossovers, but obviously you can't have the Doctor meeting up with the guy who fights sexy aliens too often. Because kids just can't watch that.
I mean, it worked with Star Trek.
Torchwood went a bit further than that. But the first, like, it probably would have worked better with season 2 or 3 of Torchwood. I reckon the first season they were, like, over-the-top adult to try to distinguish themselves. Then the second season they settled in and did some really good character work on the Torchwood team. Children of Earth is a really good story, and then Miracle Day was a bit rubbish because it was dragged out too long, I think. But, so anyway, they can't just slam them together because of the adult content in Torchwood. You can't put that in Doctor Who. But they have done big cinematic universe crossovers before.
Yeah, yeah.
So, moving along, we've ended up talking about this a lot more than I'd planned. But that's just how, you know, excited I am for this.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
It's absolutely nuts news that I never expected to happen. And I didn't realise I would be so excited for it to happen, but I am. I want Doctor Who to be exciting and big again. I want people to be talking about it, and not in a bad way.
Well, hopefully the BBC won't screw it up.
Yes, hopefully. So for our second topic tonight, when did you last upgrade your computer?
Not too long ago, actually. Not too long ago.
I know, I helped you.
Yep. It was fun.
And it was bloody expensive, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Very expensive. Especially especially the graphics card.
Yeah, graphics cards are awful right now. Ugh. We're seeing a really weird shift in the market right now. So back in the 90s, PC gaming was expensive. You'd have to upgrade your computer every year or two because the rate of change in the industry was just that high. Then in the 2000s and 2010s, it settled down. Things were nice and calm. You could buy a part and get a few years out of it. Particularly when AMD flopped and Intel didn't bother doing anything innovate for the next 10 years. But now we've got Ryzen, and AMD has got some amazing stuff coming out. But Intel has realized what's going on and started innovating. And, you know, I think the last couple of years, in terms of technological advance, have been some of the most exciting in PC gaming in a long time. But you can't get any of the parts because of the bloody silicon shortage. And when you can get the parts, you can't get them for a reasonable price.
Nah, it's
gaming
always...
on PC is now a, like, super rich people thing.
It's a pipe dream at this point.
Yeah, you used to be able to build a gaming PC for about the same as the cost of an Xbox. It wouldn't always perform exactly the same as an Xbox. It was, you know, we used to talk about console killer PCs. Because at that point, manufacturers were actually making GPUs and CPUs that were competitive with the consoles and selling them at a competitive price. Unfortunately, with the massive silicon shortage right now, and it doesn't look like that's going to go anywhere anytime soon, it's become completely impossible to buy even the lowest end parts for a reasonable price. Along with that, they've stopped making the cheap parts as well. The entry level parts just don't seem to be getting made, probably because of the silicon shortage. Why sell a part that only goes for $200 or $300? You can sell a part that you know will go for $1,000.
Could it also be the fact that COVID is affecting the situation as well?
Well, that's part of the reason for the silicon shortage. It's a big complicated ball of mess, but with the start of COVID, you know, 2 years ago nearly, some of the silicons, well, were shut down because their employees are infected. Car manufacturers decided not to buy any silicon that year because nobody's going to buy a car in a pandemic. For some reason, people bought cars in a pandemic. And suddenly there wasn't enough silicon supply to go around. And that's led to absolutely insane things, like parts that are 3 or 4 years old selling for more than they did when they were new.
And not to mention nowadays with some parts, they've decided to go into the Bitcoin mining era.
Yeah, NVIDIA's crypto mining platform, bloody hate it. It's just like anti-environment, anti-consumer. They're diverting chips from graphics card development to make crypto mining cards, which are good for a year or two and then go straight into the garbage. But people will still use a graphics card that's a few years old. People will still buy it off you if you want to sell it, even before the ridiculous price hikes.
Yeah, but then here's the thing, though. Nvidia has invested a lot of money in it, though.
Of course they do. That's what any company that wants to make money does.
And the sad and the sad part is you're seeing lots of people just buying a bucket load of GPUs with crypto mining abilities and running them constantly.
Yeah.
Like, I saw one video where someone bought like 30 GPUs and just run them constantly in a room. I mean, Jesus.
That can be bad for you, actually. Chubby Emu has a video about a guy who had a heat stroke because he was running too much mining stuff in his bedroom.
Wait, what?
He was running like a dozen computers in his bedroom and it just got too hot and he had heat stroke.
Damn.
Yeah, if you want to have some fun, go to PC Part Picker, pick a part, and then look at the price history for the last 2 years. Unfortunately, the price history doesn't go back any further than that. But some of the parts there, you can see a massive spike in the price from reasonable to ridiculous.
All right, let's see. What part shall we look at first?
Let's look at the RX 580. That's the card I'm using myself.
Okay, RX 580.
If I look at this particular RX 580, I can see that in October 2019, it was selling for about $300. In July 2021, it was selling for $430.
Which version
Not
are you...
Huge jump, but definitely more. Which is odd, because usually computer parts get cheaper the older they get.
Which version, by the way?
This is this one in particular, the ASUS Radeon RX 580 8GB Duo card.
Okay.
I'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Sure. Damn it.
So, I'm a bit worried about the future of PC gaming. I can't buy, for any amount of money, parts to help my friends build computers. I try to start my own PC building business at one point. I still do, you know, one or two a year for friends, but it's gotten ridiculous. It's at the point where I literally cannot compete as an independent, and I tell people to go to the major companies that can buy directly from Nvidia and AMD. It's a very confusing time, and I'm a bit worried that in another year or two, will we still have a budget gaming option that isn't a console?
I don't know, man. Like, the amount of scalping that's been going on in the last few months and how people are just doing this for the crypto. I mean, if crypto crashes, I think the value of the GPUs will go down significantly.
I hope it does.
But
the price goes way down.
I mean, have you seen the recent news of crypto from China?
Yeah, the swing so far hasn't been that big. Like, there's headlines that are all like, crypto crash, run! But it's not that much of a change, realistically. Like, compared to other swings over the course of a week or a month, it's not a huge difference. But what really hurts here, what crushes my heart, what kills me is having to say, go buy a console.
Oh, that does suck. That does suck. And that's what's happened now. And that's what's crazy.
Consoles are built from... You can get a console at retail price. You just can't beat that for gaming value with PC. And I hate saying that, because I've always said PCs are better. You get better performance. You can get better prices. You can get...
better customization and stuff.
Better customization. You can play all sorts of indie games. But now that indie games are more common on consoles, it's really hard not to say buy a console. And it's hurting me, DJ.
to quote Sheldon Cooper, there. I don't know, man.
It's for custom building PCs right now.
Nah, it's no place. I mean, if Nvidia decides to go, okay, we're gonna stop doing the crypto marketing. We're gonna stop entering into the crypto marketing, which I doubt they'll do. Then, yeah, maybe there is hope.
It probably won't make a big difference. because the scalping and crypto miners are just taking it all anyway.
Nah. And I think they've basically taken the fun out of like building PCs and what. And
yeah, building your PC is fun. It's an easy way to learn a little bit about electronics, computers. It's the sort of thing that should be more accessible to people.
Yeah.
Not just because I want people to play games, but because I think that, you know, learning how to build a PC and put it together and then install an operating system teaches you a lot about the computer that you're not going to know just by a pre-built. Or worse, if you only use consoles and phones. There's actually, not to get all kids these days, but one thing I've heard from some teachers is that some kids these days don't know how to use a mouse or a keyboard properly. Because they've grown up with tablets. And look, I don't want to get all kids these days because that's stupid. And
you just you just said it though.
I did. But, you know, I want people to learn technology because it's such a integral part of our lives.
But okay, that brings a very interesting question though in terms of technology. Do you reckon we're getting too ahead of ourselves in terms of the amount of tech that we're seeing?
What do you mean?
Like how GPUs are getting faster and faster in terms of it becoming like more like consoles and whatnot. Like consoles are getting more and more like PCs
Consoles are getting more and more like PCs. I think that's intentional, because building a x86-based console is easier than building one on a custom architecture. Developing for it is easier, because then you're just using an extremely well-understood architecture. But that was one of the problems with the PlayStation 3 and the PlayStation 2. Actually, the PlayStation's in general, because the Xbox has always been x86, but PlayStation has liked to do its own thing. Developing for the PlayStation was a lot harder. You could get some, if you really optimized, you could get some really interesting performance and graphics and stuff. But how many people are going to bother doing that for their game? How many games really need that? And then the new consoles are basically built using off-the-shelf parts. I can't buy the parts because of contracts, but they're not all that different to the parts that I can buy. So I think intentional thing they're doing to drive people to consoles. And yeah. I think Microsoft wants that. I don't know about Sony so much, but Microsoft would love to have more control over your tech. Because Microsoft have worked out that the way to make money right now is to create a system and then sell stuff to go with it. And they can get a bigger cut from people buying games and software for an Xbox than they can for selling stuff for PC.
Could you see Google doing this? In the near future.
Well, they've tried to get into consoles with Stadia, which went as well as you'd expect.
Yeah, it was as well as someone trying to do a bomb in the pool, but didn't work out. but what about operating system wise though?
You have the weirdest bloody metaphors.
I know. But what about OS wise though? You reckon Google would join the OS market?
They already have. Android is based on Linux and is an operating system.
True, but that's
Chrome
only for...
Chrome OS is also somewhere in between a desktop Linux and Android.
Hmm.
Google are already in the OS business.
Okay.
But we should move it along to our next topic. More technology, because we love technology here. And for once, it's an Aussie piece of tech.
Yay!
Hey, don't sound so glum. An Aussie startup has made a new solar cell which is significantly, and when I say significantly, it's going to sound like nothing, but it's significantly cheaper and more efficient than existing tech. So when I say that, their cell is 25.54% efficient. That means that for every 100% of sunlight that hits it, it absorbs 25.54% of that energy and converts it to electricity. Prior to that, the record was 25.26%. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it's pretty big deal, solar tech.
Hmm.
And their big secret is using copper instead of silver. Currently, solar cells use up about 15% of the world's industrial silver. Copper is a lot more abundant. So they've not only improved the tech, they've also made it cheaper and easier to make. So now can we put solar panels everywhere?
Ooh. Although the downside is going to be, I wonder how many solar panel ads are we going to see on YouTube now?
Whenever I turn off Adblock, I get tons of ads about the solar rebates.
It's like,
I don't even
quiz.
Own a house. How am I going to put solar on a rental? Like, I'm a millennial, I'm probably never going to own a house.
Oh, like, it's like Queensland solar rebates. Like, stop, please, stop.
Yeah, I've never looked at them. I'm sure half of them are scams. But the so good news is we have this coming from inside Australia, and they're working on building a facility to mass produce it here. Should be very nice to have a locally mass produced solar cell.
I mean, it's good to see like local companies designing new tech and improving stuff. Good to see it. What's going to be interesting is how you're going to play this in other climates. Like, Australian climate is one thing, but trying to do it on other climates is going to be it'll be a big test.
Yeah, one of the big issues with renewable energy has traditionally been transporting the energy and storing the energy, because renewables have never been able to run 24/7. Well, some of them can, but the ones you think of, wind and solar, don't. For obvious reasons, sometimes the sun's not up, and sometimes it's not windy. You can work around that by combining the two. Often when it's not sunny, it's windy. Often when it's not windy, it's sunny. But obviously, there's still some issues. Then you have energy storage, which there are ways to do it which are efficient. Pumped hydro is a popular one. Not so great in Australia because we don't have any hills.
So where do you think would be the best place to start testing it out? If you want to see this applicable in the worldwide front?
Well, I think just start building these instead of regular silver solar panels. It's cheaper and uses less energy to manufacture, so if they can get mass production down, which to be fair is a major issue with a lot of tech, like carbon nanotubes, which anything except to leave the lab, but if they can get this thing mass produced, it will be, you know, a game changer for solar production. And by making it so much cheaper, this means you have the resources to build more solar to make up for the days that it's cloudy.
Another question would be, how long before Elon Musk buys the tech?
Look, as much as I can't stand the guy, if he bought this, I'd be happy, because he'd be backing a technology that's great. Like, he already has Solar City, but I think it was a bit of a flop. But maybe if they could make these cheaper, it would work out better. I don't know. I'm not an expert in business.
I mean, I think if I recall, Elon did do something about Adelaide's power crisis at one point.
Yeah, Elon sponsoring South Australia Battery Bank, because we found out that South Australia can't make enough power for itself. So it gets a lot of power from the other states, but there's no redundancy in that. So when the power use spikes in South Australia, it can cause the whole system to crash. Or if the wind blows over the power line, the whole system crashes. We didn't plan that one very well, did we?
No. Yeah, the Hornsdale Power Reserve, that's what it was called.
Yeah, and I think that was built using battery packs developed by Tesla.
Yeah. Yeah, for a capital cost of $90 million.
But I think it worked out to be free for Australia, didn't it?
Yeah,
like, he basically donated it, because he had some deal that if it didn't do X, it would be free. Did that come to fruition?
Actually, it was a so Elon Musk placed a wager that the battery would be completed within 100 days from contract signature. Otherwise, the battery would be free. Free. Yeah.
What did it cost? Did it come out for free?
The 63 days between the grid contract and completion easily beat Musk's wager of 100 days. So
fair enough. I suppose that's the deal he made. He can have the money. I'm quite excited about this, and it's nice to see some high-tech cool stuff going on here. something that isn't mining, or sheep. You see, there's more sheep in Australia than there are in New Zealand. The thing is, we don't have an association of doing things to the sheep, because we don't do it.
Like, so...
get an association for being inappropriate around sheep by not being inappropriate around sheep, so...
Man, that sounds confusing. My brain. Ow, my brain.
Alright, well, I'll give you a moment for it to recover while we do our sponsor break, and then move on to the shout-out.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
So first up, we have on the 20th of September, Mark McGinty, the video game artist who produced cover art for Street Fighter 2 and Streets of Rage 2. He passed away... Yeah, I was there, but he passed away on the 20th of September. So I'm assuming you know about this guy, right, DJ? You're a fighting game fan?
Yeah, he was the man behind the legendary Street Fighter 2 album game cover, I mean.
The Western version, anyway.
Yeah, yeah. And, boy, Street Fighter 2, that was a great game back in the day.
Actually, speaking of, like, Western version game art, I love the Ashens videos. He does lectures about terrible games and stuff sometimes. One of them he did was terrible video game art, and it compares some of the art for games in Japan and in the West. This one is one that's aged a bit better than some of the ones Ashens goes on about. The 21st of September, endangered South African penguins, 63 of them, were killed by a swarm of bees near Cape Town.
Ugh.
Yes, it's the first known attack at Boulder's Beach. Usually the penguins and bees coexist. Unfortunate that this has happened, because this is just going to further provoke the war between penguins and the bees. You know which side we stand on, don't we, DJ?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Penguins forever.
Oh, yes. And we shall finish building the our first battle cruiser and name it the SS Penguin.
Yeah, I hope they get this sorted out. 60, like, I don't know how many of these African penguins there are in the wild, but 60 is quite a large chunk of them who die in. I hope it hasn't completely destroyed the breeding population. And on the 22nd of September, we pass the 10th anniversary of Dark Souls.
Oh boy.
Yeah, that one's quite a famous one.
So how many times have you failed in that game?
I haven't played it.
Oh, you...
I plan to, but I haven't played it.
Oh, you lucky soul.
Yeah, despite being ridiculously hard, people seem to love it.
Well, they seem to love it because they're gluttons for punishment. I mean, that game is punishingly hard.
Yeah, there's a lot of spin-offs and inspirations that have come up from that series. I mean, it's one of those ones that I've been meaning to get in really my teeth into it, because it seems like one of those games where you want to get into and then spend a good amount of time working on it. I just haven't.
If I recall, the studio behind the Dark Souls game is now working with George R.R. Martin.
Elden Ring.
Yeah.
That looks interesting. I'm not sure if it'll ever be finished, though.
I mean, we're looking at George R.R. Martin's... work ethic here.
Yeah, maybe the game will be finished, but the story won't.
Nah. Speaking of story, though, the Dark Souls story is very... It's nobody has ever figured out what the story of the Dark Souls is.
Really? I thought people were quite across that. Like, there's a lot of piecing it together from the multiple games, but I thought people understood that.
Yeah. There was a I recall there was a contest to say what was the Dark Souls story in. Yeah, there we go. It was a lore contest. Here we go. So yeah, Bandai. Hang on a second. He made a video. He made a video about it. The biography.
Tell me more. Somebody made a video for a lore contest.
Yep.
And what? They got it wrong.
They got it right. It was a $10,000 reward for it.
Well, that's pretty cool. And on the 24th of September, we had the anniversary, the 20th one, of ECO, spelled ICO, by the developers who are probably better known for the Shadow of the Colossus and The Last Guardian. That's another one with a confusing plot that people love. It's interesting that they do the storytelling with minimal dialogue. Funnily enough, Hidetaki Miyazaki from Software, who created Demon's Souls and Dark Souls, is a big fan of ECO. And for our remembrances, on the 21st of September 1984, Mikimoto Kokichi, sure, sorry, a Japanese entrepreneur who created the first cultured pearl. It's hard to believe that cultured pearls have only been around for, 100 years or so.
I mean, it's insane how the pearl industry is lucrative.
Rare and interesting to look at, so lots of people want to spend money on it.
Oh, yeah.
So, after his death in 19... Mikimoto was honored as one of Japan's 10 greatest inventors by the Japanese Patent Office. It's really interesting that it took them this long to figure it out as well. They basically take a pearl and mix in a bit of irritant. I think they use mussel shell mostly these days. And the oyster grows a pearl around the irritant. And he actually started working with his first pearl oyster farm in 1888 and created the orchard pearl in 1893.
It's a very long, long process.
Yeah. He died at 96 in Japan. The whole process takes months or years.
Mm.
We actually have a decently sized pearl industry up in Western Australia.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how much of it is still active. I understand it's a lot smaller now that cultured pearls are more common, but there's still prestige in buying, natural pearls.
I mean, can you imagine as well with the cultured pearls, like trying to find the authenticity of it? It'd be very, very hard to do it, though.
Yeah, it would be hard because the oyster's just doing what it does naturally. And for our famous birthday, on the 21st of September 1902, we have Alan Lane, a British publisher, who with his brothers Richard and John founded Penguin Books in 1935. He worked at Bodley Head and became managing editor in 1925. After conflict with the board of directors, who were fearful of being prosecuted for publishing Ulysses, Lane joined up with Richard and John to found Penguin Books and publish Ulysses themselves. And the legend, which is actually in the back of a lot of books, is that Alan Lane was on a train platform and had nothing to read. He was from visiting Agatha Christie in 1934. Then he was like, hey, what if we made books? And like really cheap books that you can just buy at a train station. The first Penguin book vending machine was set up outside Henderson's in Charing Cross Road and called Penguincubator.
Man, naming was not their strong suit, wasn't it?
No. Other booksellers and authors were against paperbacks, thinking that people would spend less money on books. I don't know, being able to buy cheap paperbacks is like pretty significant, I think.
That statement has not aged well.
Yeah.
Although, mind you, I bet you they might be laughing now that online is coming into the fold.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of bookstores that have shut down in the past 20 years.
Hmm.
Who absolutely failed and missed the boat at becoming online booksellers.
And that's where Amazon came in.
Yep. For our event of interest, on the 21st of September 2003, we have the termination of the Galileo probe. So, because of concerns about the Galileo probe carrying contamination to other planets, which is a big issue. If you find aliens, how do you know they were there before we got there? How do you know that they haven't been contaminated by a previous space mission? So, they decided the solution is to take the Galileo probe and throw it into Jupiter. Yeah, it's a big deal these days about sterilizing spaceships, particularly landers for other planets. There was a serious debate about Curiosity, especially when they realized somebody hadn't sterilized the drill bits.
Wait, was that actually a thing, or is this...
No, it's a real thing. They forgot to sterilize the drill bits and didn't realize until they got to Mars.
Oh,
what
no.
They did, it was obviously too late.
I'd hate to be the intern who forgot to clean that.
Yeah. And on the 21st of September 1994, Dinosaur Island released in Japan on home video. The premise is that an army captain flying three misfit deserters home for court-martial crash lands on an uncharted island. They find a primitive society of cave women who sacrifice virgins to appease the Great One, a dinosaur on the island. Mistaken for gods, the men must destroy the Great One or face death. But meanwhile, they fall in love.
Why does it remind me of a certain Futurama episode?
Futurama borrowed a lot from sci-fi, older sci-fi.
Remember that? You know which episode I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, Amazon Women in the Mood.
Yep. I wonder
I
if
the synopsis is ambiguous. We don't know that the men fell in love with the Amazons. Maybe they fell in love with each other. The real love was the prisoners we met along the way. And something that definitely wouldn't fly these days, actress Antonia Dorian had to do a topless scene. She was, like, a love scene as well. So she was nervous because she was on a set surrounded by men with everyone staring at her. The director gave her wine to calm her nerves.
I mean, there have been worse, though. I mean, what was it? You remember the movie Apocalypse Now?
Yep.
Okay, so there's an interesting fact in that movie where Dennis Hopper couldn't perform and he was low energy, and James Coppola asked, okay, what do you need for you to improve your performance? And Hopper says, I want cocaine, lots of it. And Coppola went, done.
Bloody so, hell, the world was a different place back then.
Oh, yeah. So basically, his entire portrayal in the movie was him just high as a kite.
I also like that they messed up the blocking for one scene where the warriors are chasing a dinosaur, and you can see houses in the background. You'd think that would be a pretty simple thing to check for.
Uh-huh. Imagine being
that's
the...
That's all we have for tonight, DJ. Where can they find us?
They can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, thatsnotcanon.com, where we have an archive of our old and new episodes, and That's Not Canon podcasts, such as Cast Party. Quiet on set, we're rolling in 3, 2, welcome to Cast Party, a Dungeons & Dragons podcast thrust into the world of D&D, four cast and crew members from a Hollywood film set, to find themselves with new powers in very new places on an adventure none of them really know how to process. Follow along as our director, Colin McManus, leads our cast and crew consisting of Ryan McManus, Anna Binsman, Nigel Deacon, and Vincent Perino through this gripping and hilarious story.
And keep an eye out for our new project launching soon, Nerdful Things. That's going to be our new media review podcast, which will also feature a book club segment. And the first book club segment is going to be Forbidden Planet. So see if you can track down a copy of that for yourself before we spoil it for you. Look after yourselves, stay hydrated, and we'll see you next time.
See you guys.
Come on, DJ, put some energy into it.
Here we go!
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.